Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another live episode of The Yield. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr, and I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at YieldTreat. And today, I'm joined by Chris Speltz, who serves as the Executive Chairman and Chairman of the Board of the Savings Group, the new parent company of Rate Genius and AutoPay. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. I figured we'd start perhaps by you giving us a quick overview of who the Savings Group is and what the company does.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said in your intro there, the Savings Group was just formed in July, actually, by the merger of two great companies, Rate Genius and AutoPay. And we were both competitors prior to this merger, and competitors focused on refinancing auto loans. And so both of us have marketplaces, website marketplaces, and origination platforms that we use to drive consumers to our site and find them better rates than they have on their existing loan. So for our consumers, we save them a lot of money, typically about $100 a month. For the lenders on our platform, we give them a new earning asset. And the consumer saves a fair amount of money and our lenders get a new asset and we provide a pretty good service. And it's been pretty gratifying and a good product, especially over the last year or so, saving people money.
So I'm kind of curious, what was some of the rationale behind the merger? I mean, certainly, you know, I think a lot of consumers see mergers as being both good and bad. Sometimes they get better pricing because there's, you know, the new company has greater efficiencies and is more scaled, but also sometimes that's one less market competitor to leave the space, but can sometimes turn pricing against them. But maybe you could walk through, how this impacts customers.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. We combined the two companies because we were both, you know, we knew each other pretty well because we were competitors, obviously, but we had good respect for each other. We had similar ways of doing business, similar approaches to the market. And when we combined, we have about 180 lenders or so on our platform. So we actually gave greater access to consumers that come to our respective platforms because we, between the two companies, we increased the number of lenders on our platform, which means it gave us more ability to find a lender for a consumer because we have more choice and more ability to say, you know, here's the best lender for this consumer. And we have lenders from a local standpoint, a regional standpoint, a state standpoint, and a national standpoint. So we can find people, whether you're in a small town in Arkansas, and there might be a local lender or a state lender or a national lender that might fill that need. And so we really gave more choice and more opportunities to give consumers approvals through combining all the lenders that we have on our platform. And then there are efficiencies that you talked about that go from combining the two companies, but not people efficiencies. People hear mergers and they think about people efficiencies. That's not the case. We're actually hiring people. We've actually, between the two companies now, we probably have about 650 employees or so, which is actually up, probably 50 to 100 employees since the merger. So when we talk about efficiencies, it's more on the vendor side in terms of, because we have, two companies that are using a lot of the same vendors, and it's not people. We're hiring people and we want more people to process the additional loans that we're doing.
So you described the company as a platform, but perhaps you can kind of walk people through how it works and what they can kind of expect by coming on to your website.
Sure. It's a platform, origination platform, a marketplace. And so we drive consumers to our marketplace through, we do marketing ourselves through, we even actually do direct mail, but we do online marketing also. We have lots of partnerships that we do. You know, we do SEO and SEM. So various measures that we take and content marketing, various measures that we take to interest consumers and try to drive that intent of consumers and make them aware of the product, frankly. Probably less than half the people know that you can refinance your auto loan. Most people get an auto loan from a dealer or they get an auto loan when they purchase a car and they just stick with it. But, you know, if your circumstances change, rates go down, your score improves, your income improves, maybe you get a guarantor on your loan or a joint borrower or a joint signer on your loan. You can, if your credit circumstances change and improve, you can refinance your loan, get a better rate and save money. And so, That's what our marketplace does. We try to raise consumer awareness, let people know of this asset class. And then we drive consumers to our website. They fill out a pretty quick application, and then we match them with potential lenders. Typically, we might have 2, 3, 4 lenders to match them with. The consumer makes the choice, and then we work with them through the whole process to do the loan documentation and to do the titling. And so that's what we do for the consumers and kind of work through the whole process with them digitally, I might add. We put a lot of investment and a lot of dollars into digital over the last couple of years. And then, the net result for the consumers, I think I said, or maybe I didn't say previously, was we typically save about $95 to $100 per month for consumers that refinance with us. And so that's, you know, up to $1,200 a year, which is significant.
So essentially, you know, someone has an existing auto loan of some kind, which is interesting as well for you to mention that, you know, people think so often about refinancing their mortgage. They think about refinancing some other consumer loans, but not necessarily their auto loans, which perhaps they just kind of compartmentalize a little bit differently. But essentially, they come onto the site, they upload some details around their existing loan that they have out on whichever outstanding vehicle they're thinking about refinancing. And then essentially, you have some new lenders come in and they essentially all bid to essentially refi out that loan. Is that correct?
That's correct. And one of the investments that we made the last couple of years is one of the things we heard from our consumers was, hey, I'd just like to, you know what rate I might be able to get. And so we put a new product in place. We call it Loan Finder on the Rate Genius site. And it allows people to give us 5 or 6 pieces of information, anonymous. They don't have to give us their name and address and all those kinds of things. It's more like, hey, I think my score is this. I think I have excellent credit. I think I have good credit. Here's the kind of car I have. Here's my payment remaining. Here's the zip code that I kind of live in. And then we use that anonymous information and say, okay, you know, based on what you told us, you know, these 5 or 6 pieces of information, here's what we think you could, you know, it's not an approval, obviously, but here's what we think you could get, because people are interested to know what kind of rate could I get before they start to apply. And then we put a lot of investment in addition to that product. We also have a lot of pre-qual products, which, again, then people give us a little bit more information, including some, their personal information like name and address and those kinds of things. But it's a pre-qual, meaning that it doesn't impact your credit score. And then you can decide whether you want to go through and make an actual application. So, you know, we've put those, refined those products over the last couple of years because, you know, people want them and people have asked for them. And then they go through they can take the next step. You know, there's kind of 3 steps, you know, hey, what are rates and what might I get without giving personal information? Here's a pre-qual. I give you some personal information and it gets a little bit more targeted because we have more information. And then obviously a full application is the most accurate result we can give you because we get, you know, all the information that a lender requires to make a credit decision.
No, very interesting. I'm still very curious. I can't quite wrap my head around it. Why is it that people sort of, I don't want to say forget, but perhaps don't necessarily seek out better rates or financing for some of their auto loans as opposed to any other loan that they might have on their books?
Yeah, you know, great question. Yeah, and you know, part of it is, if people are conditioned, and you mentioned it just a second ago, people are kind of conditioned when rates drop, and rates have been dropping for the last 20 years. But, you know, when rates drop, you know, people automatically think about refinancing their mortgage, right? Or, you know, using a lot of people have used credit cards over the years to take out a zero balance credit card or a
I don't think credit card rates have changed in 20 years.
They haven't, but banks run specials. You know, they run zero balance specials for a while, and some people take advantage of that to pay off higher debt. Personal loans were big for a number of years, but that connection with auto just really isn't there for whatever reason. And, you know, less than half the people probably know you can refinance auto, and probably half of that half, maybe 20%, 30% have actually done it. So it's a real opportunity to improve your cash flow. And again, maybe take advantage of your circumstances that might have improved or changed since you bought a car at a dealership or, you know, through a used car situation, whatever. You know, most people, the car buying experience is kind of still the same. That's not the most pleasant experience. I don't think you'd find a lot of people saying that experience is pleasant or joyful. And so a lot of people just take, first of all, a lot of people don't, you know, line up their financing ahead of time when they are purchasing a car. So a lot of people just take what the dealership offers because it's easy, it's there. But again, if circumstances change and the situation improves, we can usually save, this last quarter in September, we saved over 600 basis points for people on average when we refinance their loan. So it's something to think about, and some time investment is worthwhile.
So I'm also kind of curious, and I want to talk a lot about what's going on with the auto market, because it's certainly been in the news. And I think people are finding out just using simple web-based valuations, but they're seeing a lot of essentially equity being created in some used cars.
Yeah.
Maybe you could spend a little time talking about, you know, again, while people might not necessarily assume this, their car that they've had for 3 years might be worth a lot more now than it was just a couple of months or so ago. Are you seeing a lot of people take advantage of that new equity valuation as a way to sort of extract some equity from their auto loan?
Yeah, for sure. And what's happened is with the pandemic, every single auto manufacturer shut down at some point in time. And so you had shutdowns because of the pandemic in 20. Now it's more supply chain issues and semiconductor issues, because a new car now has up to 1,000 semiconductors in it. I mean, massive amounts of semiconductors. And so there's supply chain issues with semiconductors going on right now. And all those things add up to less new cars and used cars being sold. In September, typically new cars run at about 16 to 17 million new cars sold per year. In September, that run rate was down to 12. So a huge decrease, almost a 25-30% decrease. And used cars typically run about 40 million sales per year. And in September, the run rate was more like 35-36, so down about 10% run rate, right? So a lot less cars turning over, which means the value of your, existing car goes up. And there's an index, I think it's called the Manheim Index of used cars. It's wholesale value and that they track. And that's up almost 50% over the last year and a half. And there was a big leg up in 20 because of the shutdowns of the manufacturing that I talked about. And then there was another leg up in 21 because of the supply chain issues that I just referenced. And so that index, and it's an index, but that index right now is like at 200 or so versus like 140 at the beginning of 2020. So there is value in cars, and which lends, again, it's another reason why people should consider refinancing, because these are secured loans. And so the lenders are lending, to you, Peter, as an individual with your credit score and your income, but also they're lending against the collateral of the asset that you have and the collateral value of that auto. And so auto values are up. So it improves your chances of getting approved. And it improves your chances of getting a good rate, assuming you have a decent score, decent payment history, decent income, and now increasing collateral.
Yeah. So in that kind of example, let's say that someone owned a car, and correct me where I'm wrong, but essentially if someone owned a car and let's say it was worth $10,000, maybe at the beginning of the year or so, and they had a loan on that 80%, let's just say for easy numbers. So they had about an $8,000 loan and about $2,000 worth of equity essentially in the car. The car appreciated now to $1,500 or $15,000 rather for simple numbers. You can now actually borrow up more, right, above that $10,000 limit, and certainly find a way to monetize it. Now, of course, everyone's situation is different, but I would imagine people are taking advantage of that kind of increased value of their cars.
There's not, you're hitting on a distinction between the real estate market and the car market. There's not that many lenders that'll do like a cash out, like you're talking about.
Oh, right? Okay. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. There's some, but there's not a lot. There's some lenders that'll do it. It's much more prevalent, you know, on the real estate side where people take out home equity lines of credit and or refi and take some equity out of their house. There are some lenders, but it's not as prevalent on the other side. But your example is correct in that people are building equity in their cars because to go back to your example, it might have been 8,000 at the beginning of the year, but they made payments on it also, right? So the 8,000 might now be, I'm making up numbers, might be 7,500 or whatever, right? And then the car went from, in your example, from 10,000 to, you know, 11, 12, 13,000, whatever the number was. And so they are building equity in their car, which again, it's a little bit harder to take out equity in a loan, but if they can find a car to buy, they could use that to, trade in and get some equity that way.
So you also kind of mentioned quite a bit around supply being down across new and also used cars. How has demand sort of evolved coming out of the pandemic?
Demand for refi or for cars?
Cars, yeah.
For either one, yeah. I think demand's there. It's just the supply is such a problem. The Federal Reserve puts out quarterly auto loan originations, and for the last 2 years, the average amount of loans, auto loans, originated each quarter was about $150 billion, give or take. In June, the last quarter that the Fed reported, the dollar amount of auto originations jumped to $200 billion. And so the demand's there, even though, and that gives you an example of what we were just talking about, because even though less cars are being sold, the amount financed went up by $50 billion in the last quarter, which means that on less volume, which means, you know, there is the cars that are being sold and financed or maybe refied, bigger dollar amounts, right? Bigger dollar amounts going on.
Yeah.
So there is demand. The demand's there. The demands are in the numbers. And it's probably going to take another year or so. Intel and IBM recently came out and said that those two companies, those two software and chip companies, said they didn't see a relief from the semiconductor shortage until sometime in 22, if not the end of 22.
What are some of the big drivers for the lack of kind of semiconductors available for distribution at this point?
I think it's a combination of the supply chain in general got kind of screwed up with all the, you know, there's some, my sister lives in San Pedro on the coast of California. She can look out her window and see the supply ships sitting off the coast of California. And you can see some pretty interesting maps that show supply ships, literally like 50, 60 of them just sitting around. So supply chains kind of got screwed up. I think just the demand for electronics and the demand of connectivity and the Internet of Things and, you know, everything has, you know, your refrigerator talks to your phone now. And well, that all takes chips, right? So just all the electronics, all the Internet of Things, 5G, you know, there's just so many different things that are new and coming on demanding chips. And I mentioned cars before, you know, now there's hundreds and up to 1,000 chips in cars. And so just everything demanding more and more chips, hitting at a time that there's supply chain issues. And there was probably some hoarding going on too, frankly. You know, there might've been hoarding going on last year by some of the manufacturers. So yeah, I think all those things are kind of combining to cause some of the issues.
No, very interesting. So turning back to the savings group, you know, and sort of this, you know, this recent, you know, coming together of two strong companies. I'm curious, you know, how has sort of, you know, the market overall for, you know, auto loans and auto loan refinancing sort of evolved coming out of the global financial crisis, and kind of where do you see it going from here as well?
It's been, and this is again, there, you know, there was so much. And I'm talking financially now only, right? Because there was so much, you know, physiological and psychological, you know, issues and problems over the last year and a half. But financially speaking, it's just for all the things that we just talked about, it's just the demand has really been strong. There was a little bit of a dip called in when the pandemic first hit in kind of March, April. But then after that, the demand's just been strong. And, you know, we've continued to have really strong demand and increasing demand. Because we're saving people money and people were looking to do just that. People were looking to get into cars and get out of public transportation and ride sharing, especially back in 2020. Those things are starting to ameliorate now. But there was a survey I saw recently that said, I think it was almost 80%. It was like 77, 78% of people strongly said that you need to own a vehicle. And I think that's coming out of 2020 with, you know, concerns about ride sharing and public transportation and those kinds of things. And then, you know, there was a move to the suburbs too. You know, there's a lot of different things that caused demand and caused people to change their behavior. And all those things resulted in demand for auto and demand for auto loans then. And so it's been a good year and a half, 2 years for our business and for the consumers that we serve and our lenders. It's been good for all three parties involved, which is obviously the recipe for a successful business. When all three parties are happy, then you know that's a good thing. All three parties, being the consumer, the lenders, and the savings group.
Yeah, and maybe this extends a little bit beyond just, you know, in terms of auto financing and sort of auto loans, but how has the health of the consumer, you know, kind of rebounded from the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great question.
People are first focusing internally with their own financial situation, but yeah, certainly the job market has evolved as well.
It has. It's a great question. It's counterintuitive to what people might think. The average credit score in 2020 actually went up. FICO came out recently and said the average credit score went up to about 711, which was, I think, an all-time high over at least the last 15, 20 years. So while all these things were going on, the average credit score actually went up. And then if I look at auto loans, all auto loans, not just refinance, and I look at the average auto score, or if I look at the 25th percentile, or even down to the 10th percentile, which is, you know, a lower credit quality borrower, they all went up over the last year and a half. Their scores, they stayed the same or went up, which again is counterintuitive, given that, you know, at one point in time, unemployment went up to 15%, but that was pretty short-lived. It came down pretty quickly by the end of 2020. And you had, you know, literally trillions of dollars from the federal or from the government, right, in terms of relief programs. And you continue to have low rates, and the unemployment rate came back down pretty quickly. So, you know, counterintuitively, credit scores, especially for mortgages and for autos, actually improved. And then on average for the whole country, they improved during 2020 and into 21. Also, they've continued to improve when I look at the average auto scores per the Federal Reserve. So it's been counterintuitive, but it also a testament to what's been done over the last year and a half from you know, governments.
In terms of lenders, and this can be both on your platform as well as, you know, maybe just more broadly, but, you know, lenders, just knowing some of the backdrop, are they now extending credit maybe to, you know, lower quality consumers in ways they weren't before the pandemic, or do they kind of retreat a little bit and are focusing really on high quality, if you will, consumers for the most part, as far as where they extend credit?
The biggest share of auto loans have gone to people between 620 and call it 740. When I look at the people within that credit score range, they've increased their share of auto loans by call it 300, 400 basis points over the last year and a half. So it's been a pretty wide spectrum. It's not just super prime. It's not just 740 and above or 800 and above. It's all the way down to 620, which is, you know, more in the subprime or poor, you know, range, right? So it's been a wide range from 620 to 740 that have been the biggest beneficiaries. We a lot of our lenders of the lenders on our platform are credit unions who are actually very big in the auto space. They're very big lenders in the auto space, and the credit unions are just aggressive to lend all those trillions of dollars that the federal government has been and state governments have been giving out over the last year and a half in relief packages has to end up somewhere, right? People's savings rates, at one point in time, the savings rate went up to like 30% of, you know, disposable income. And right now, it's probably 10%, which is above normal. All that money ends up somewhere. And guess what? It ends up in the banks, in the credit unions. And so our credit unions on our platform right now, one thing we follow is loans to deposits, because it gives an indication of how aggressive they are to lend. Right now, on average, the credit unions, not just on our platform, but in general, credit unions across the country are at about a 70% loan to deposit ratio, or less than 70%. Actually, it's about 68, 69%. That's the lowest it's been in probably 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And, you know, typically they might want it more up in the high 70s, 80s or something like that, if not even higher, because it just means they have a lot of deposits and not, you know, a lot of earning assets to use those deposits and make loans with. So our lenders are aggressive. They've actually continued to kind of cut rates, even though rates have maybe ticked up a little bit over the last couple weeks. So, yeah, that's...
I know you want to talk about rates. I'm going to get there, I promise.
Yeah, okay.
I do have one more question before then, and that is really just you talked a lot about credit unions as being large participants in this space, but I'm kind of curious, was that always the case, or did anything kind of that came out as far as, you know, changes to regulatory policy post-global financial crisis create new opportunities for these type of lenders, or how has that market kind of evolved?
That's been the case for a while, that they've been aggressive in the space. They use platforms like us to do what's called direct lending, because they're loaning directly to the consumers. But the credit unions and banks too, but a lot of the credit unions we deal with also do indirect lending, which is when, again, if you go back to that example I was using before, if you're at the dealership and you're taking the, you're going to say, hey, I'll apply through the dealership. In a lot of cases, that's a credit union behind the dealership, and your loan will end up with a credit union if you're buying a car at a dealership. And so they have those indirect loans. They have direct loans that they make through their branches, and they make through platforms and origination, you know, businesses like us. So, but they've always been pretty big in the business of auto lending. It's been one of their, behind real estate, it's probably their second biggest lending category within the credit union space.
No, that's great. All right, Chris, turning it over to you. Where are rates now, and where are they going?
Man, so rates have been, and I'm talking about the federal funds rates right now, right?
We'll start there. Then we'll talk about the whole.
Yeah, we'll start there, because that everything feeds off there and starts there, right? So essentially, the federal funds rate, except for a small time period during 17 and 18, federal funds have basically been at zero, right? They tried to increase them in 17 and 18. They went from like zero to like 2%. The market hated it. Everything started, you know, there was a lot of pressure on the Fed to reverse that. And they started reversing it in 19 before the pandemic. They reversed it in 19 before the pandemic hit. And then the pandemic hit, it took them back down to zero. So except for like a, call it a year and a half, 2 year window during 17 and 18, rates have, at the federal funds level, have essentially been at zero since 2008, 2009. And so, and then in the meantime, the federal debt has gone from about $9 trillion at 2008, 2009 to about 23, 20, whatever the number is, 25 trillion, something like that, right? So my question is, can they let rates go up? Because right now the average interest rate on the federal debt is about 1.4, 1.5% on average across all that $25 trillion. So let's say rates go up 1%. That's $220 billion or whatever of additional interest rates. If rates go up 5%, that's an additional $1 trillion in interest on the federal debt. Are they going to let that happen? Can they let that happen?
It's a bit of a fresh take. I haven't heard it from the concept, from the perspective of interest costs for the Fed.
Yeah, because the Fed's been the beneficiary of zero interest rates for the last 20 years. And so the majority of their debt, the federal debt outstanding, the majority of the debt is in like the, call it 2 to 10 year range, is the majority of the debt that they issue. And so their average interest rate is like 1.5%. Well, you know, that, like I said, if rates go up every 100 basis points, rates go up, that's an additional 200 and something billion dollars of interest costs. If rates went back to where they were prior to 2009, they were, Fed funds rates were at 5-6%. So that'd be about $1 trillion of interest. That's a huge amount of money when the federal budget is only a couple of $1 trillion, right? So my question is, can rates go up? Will they let rates go up?
It's an interesting perspective. I certainly have some differing points of view, particularly around the fact that, you know, in a fiat monetary system where you can print all the money you want, what is interest cost anyway? But that's a whole nother story.
Well, that's a different take. Can they inflate away all the debts, which is probably what they'll do, right? They'll probably inflate away all the debts.
I think the question then becomes a little bit around what does this mean for consumer rates, right? So if you say that roughly speaking, Fed funds rate stays anchored at or near zero, you know, at least for the next 6 to 12 months or so. Certainly there are some projections and members of the FOMC who want to start raising rates sooner rather than later, and probably on a more aggressive path than I think the market will really prefer. But how does that kind of impact borrowing rates for consumers? Or do you think that, you know, it's just kind of 25, 50 basis points and lenders will kind of just write it off and and eat sort of the loss spread, if you will.
Yeah, let me clarify. I actually do think rates will go up some, right? They just can't stay. But you know, will there be a massive increase in rates in the short term? I don't know. Maybe it might be more gradual as they kind of flay away the debts, like I was saying a second ago. But so far, what we've seen is what the last point that you just made. So far, we've seen lenders, especially, and I'm talking now just lenders on our platform. For the most part, they've kind of kept rates the same. Some of them are actually still decreasing rates a little bit for borrowers. And so far, they've been absorbing, you know, the rate increase, because there has been, since the beginning of the year, rates have gone up, call it 50, 60, 70 basis points if you're looking at the 5 to 10 year treasury notes. So rates have gone up some, but thus far our lenders have actually kept rates the same, or actually a fair amount of them have been decreasing them, because I think it goes back to that loan to deposit ratio that I was talking about before, right? They want some additional earning assets. You know, if the average car loan is, call it 6 to 7 years right now, probably it's somewhere between 6 and 7 years. And, you know, a borrower might get, or a lender might get, depending on the credit score, but on average, they might get, you know, 4, 5, 6% on a 6 to 7 year car loan. Well, if you don't do that, you can invest it in the Fed notes at, you know, 1.2 or 1.3, right? So, you know, there's still some margin there, and there's still some, you know, differential between what they can lend it out on autos and what they could maybe just invest it in with treasuries.
Yeah, and I think that's something that, you know, you see across markets, right? Is that the overall yield levels are coming down. Let's exclude kind of treasuries from this discussion. But overall, I mean, you know, for any one bank, they'd all love to stay at, let's call it 7% or whatever the number is, right? But each time they see kind of more competition coming at 7%, well, you know what, relative to everything else I could do, I could probably only earn 3 or 4. So yeah, why don't go down to 6.75? Then obviously, you know, more pressure on it that way. So hopefully, you know, rates, at least if they were to stay in their kind of, you know, current range or so, likely will continue to, I would presume, be beneficial for consumers as rates will continue to trickle down slowly as more and more money kind of just sits unproductively and needs to be put to use somewhere. So hopefully that's all positive for consumers in that front. And certainly I imagine extends beyond just autos and certainly the kind of the whole borrowing complex.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just kind of curious overall, you know, about, you know, what else your company kind of is thinking about going forward, and what, you know, you guys are all most excited about as you kind of really, I imagine, finish, you know, sort of integrating both companies and also kind of look forward to 2022 and 2023.
Yeah, we're excited. We're you know, we picked the name The Savings Group because it, you know, it gives us opportunities to think about other consumer products, right? We're in the business of helping consumers save money, improve their financial circumstances, their financial position. We do it right now through refinancing auto loans. And right now the idea is to stay within that market because we think there's still a lot of opportunity. The total auto loan market, or the total auto loans outstanding, are about $1.4 trillion. And as I said previously, typically anywhere between $150 to $200 billion new originations per quarter, new loans taken out. The refinancing part of the market is only about $40 to $50 billion per year. So there's new auto loans of $150 to $200 per quarter, but per quarter the refinancing is only, you know, is only like 40 to 50, you know, divided by 4. So, you know, roughly 10 or so, right? Billion. And so, you know, we think there's still a lot of opportunity to A, get more of that market share, and B, raise consumer awareness. And, you know, hopefully we're doing that today, right now. Raising consumer awareness of why consumers should do this, why it's beneficial, how they can save money. And it's a pretty easy process, right, to do it. And so we think there's a lot of opportunity to continue in the markets that we're in right now, and to gain market share, and to further the market also through consumer awareness and through the marketing that we do.
No, that's really exciting. And certainly here at YieldTree, we obviously very much subscribe towards, you know, technology-enabled platforms to help kind of connect people who maybe previously had very thick levels of friction in sort of finding each other.
Yeah, and that's a great way to put it. Yep.
Yeah. So Chris, want to turn it back over for you. Anything we sort of didn't get a chance to talk about that is really top of mind for you?
No, I think we hit a lot of good topics and some good conversation there. I appreciate it.
Yeah, this was great. And thank you so much for joining us today. For all of our listeners, be sure to join us next week for another live episode as we welcome the billionaire boxer Joe Fournier to the show. To listen to other episodes of The Yield, please visit and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and Spotify. And for any questions on Yield Street, please visit www.yieldstreet.com or email us at investments@yieldstreet.com.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.